You're listening to DottoTech, helping you get the most out of your technology wherever you use it, at home, at school, or at work. Brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. 20 years, the trusted voice of technology in Canada, Steve Dotto.
Hello and welcome to DottoTech. I'm Steve Dotto and we are glad you are joining us today. We are Art Factor and myself, Steve Dotto. How are you doing, Art?
I'm well, thank you, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Last week was fun.
That was a lot of fun, yeah.
We had App Wednesday, and we had a new champion on App Wednesday. And
I didn't like that.
I know you didn't like that because you wanted it to be you, but it was legit. I mean, the apps that he brought forward were great. And then we had our first ever DottoTech Beer and Wings Night at the Hudson's Landing Pub in Vancouver. It was fun.
It was quite the cornucopia of people out there.
It was a good turnout. We had about 38 people register, but only about 22 showed up. So I'm going to be pretty disappointed in a few people. And some of them are guests on the show. I'm going to have to have chats with them. You know, you can't be registering and then not showing up, Shane Burley. Did I say a name? Oh, I'm sorry. But yeah, a few of them registered there and they didn't show up.
Bigger incentive next time.
Well,
you should have promised hugs.
No.
I'm just saying.
Do you want me to go around hugging people, or are you volunteering to go around hugging people?
I'm thinking that you would be the hugger.
Maybe we should just hire surrogate huggers.
That's a possibility too.
Because a surrogate hugger would be fine. I think everybody would be comfortable with that. We've got a great show lined up today. We're going to be talking about Twitter with Don Power. We're going to be talking about taxes and accounting and stuff with Eileen Reppenhagen. And we have on the phone with me, as promised this week, we have right now Jillian Shaw from the Vancouver Sun. How are you doing, Jillian?
Hi, Steve.
You good?
I'm great.
Good. And we also have John Beeler from johnbeeler.com online. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, Steve.
Good. Now, the reason that these two are on is they were both in the inner circle being given versions of the new Samsung Galaxy S4 last week, along with yours truly. And we've been testing out, and this is not a phone. No. When you first turn on the Samsung Galaxy S4, it proudly states in its splash screen that it is your life companion. They actually call it that on the screen. No longer is it a phone. It's not even a smartphone, not a superphone, no, but it has graduated to the term life companion. First of all, I'm just blown away by that. The fact that this is now more important than the person who I live my life with.
What? Is it gonna last longer than most marriages, Steve?
I don't know. I don't think so, because Samsung seems to build it, you know, like for a 2 year. It's not that robustly built, is it? It's not like it doesn't feel like an army tank, does it? It feels kind of lightweight as far as that goes. But I don't know if it's going to last longer than my relationships. It might if I don't pay attention to the things. So,
well, they had the S3 out not so long ago. So life companion, how long is it going to be with the S4 before they bring the successor to the life companion?
Maybe year companion. Okay, so we've all been testing it out, and I just want to go around and talk about the key features and the things that impressed you or don't impress you about it. Overall, I think we can probably universally say it is a very impressive phone. John?
Yes, I would agree. Yeah, I think it's my favorite Samsung device I've played with so far.
Yeah. Oh, as far as they've taken this S3, which was a good phone, and they've made it that much better. It's a large screen display. It's thin. It's light. And it's just packed with features. Has Samsung gone too far though with the amount of bells and whistles that they've put in the phone?
I would think maybe. I mean, the thing is, the whole idea of a life companion is kind of compelling. And when I think about my phone usage, if I leave the house in the morning and I forget my cell phone on the charger and I'm halfway to work, I turn around and go back.
Oh, yeah.
If I leave my lunch or something else, I don't care. I'll just get another one. But my phone is a very important thing for me.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing that Samsung has done to set themselves apart is have different functionality and features that the other players just don't have. You know, Apple has been very very quiet in a lot of these types of features that Samsung has, because the simplicity has always been Apple's trademark. You know, just give me absolutely what you need and not much more. Whereas Samsung's sort of been playing this, you know, in the sandbox with all kinds of other features and functionality. And, you know, kind of like you alluded to, I'm not sure everyone's going to use these features, but it's kind of neat that they're all there if you want them.
Okay, now the one feature that I've shown everybody since I got it is they do this, they've got more sensors on than the Star Trek Enterprise, and in the front of the Samsung, of the Galaxy, is a sensor that is the camera senses where your eyes are as it's looking at it. And they do something very practical with that. If you're looking at the screen will not dim while your eyes are on the screen, which is very, very practical. But with this particular model, they have added this kind of gesture recognition, where if you're looking at the screen and then you tilt your head down slightly, it will scroll the screen up for you so you can read lower in the text, or the reverse. Tilt your head up and it scrolls down. I've shown that. I show that to everybody, and everybody's reaction is the same. Art, come online. Tell us what your reaction was, the sound you made.
There was a gasp, and then there was a, hey, come into the studio, check this thing out.
Yeah, you were telling everybody. You were just going out gathering people. It is so. Are you showing people that, Jillian? Is that what you show people first?
You know, that's funny you should say that, Steve, because that is the one thing that I was asked about before when the phone came out. Everybody said, is it true? It'll just scroll down as you look at it. So, of course, that was one of the first things I tried. I got to tell you, Steve, I just about made myself dizzy because I think I moved my head too much. And then, of course, the first thing, I tested it out with our digital editor, Bart, and we had to find out, because I thought it was eye tracking, and then so I closed my eyes and found out, no, it was not eye tracking, it was head tracking.
Uh-huh.
So takes a little bit of practice, but, you know, it's once you get it, once you practice, even me, I could get it to scroll properly. But I have to say, Steve, that is one of those things, like John says, that it's kind of, you know, it's nice they've added this feature. I don't know that I really need that unless propping my phone up on the breakfast table while I'm eating my cornflakes or something.
So a lot of these features are designed so you don't have to touch the screen and get your glommy fingers all over the screen. But I think I would – now, I do show that feature with everything, and I think it's very cool that they do it. But I think I would disable it pretty quickly because it will start to scroll when I don't want it to. Because, you know, you got to keep your head very still. And it also seems to be a little bit light dependent. Did you play with it much, John?
I did. And like you, I showed it to everybody, or everyone asked about it when I was showing it to them.
They universally respond, wow, don't they?
Yeah, no, it is a neat feature. And I think we talked before about some people think it's a little creepy.
Yeah.
But I found that it was a little too sensitive, at least for my movement. And I've had it for a week now, mm-hmm. and I'm still not quite used to it. So I tend to over-scroll or, you know, it's just not quite as connected to my brain as my thumb is as far as being in control. And that might come with time, of having more time to use it and seriously consume content with it, you know, more than just a couple of days or a week. But
they are playing with a lot of different aspects of that sort of technology. One of the other things they do is if you hover your thumb just over an area of text and hover it over, it magnifies, so it's easier to read, and it focuses. Did you guys notice that feature?
I noticed that right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a nod to the, you know, those of us who had to go buy cheater glasses.
Yeah.
We couldn't read the, you know, fine print anymore. So I thought maybe Samsung's just, you know, looking to expand its audience.
Now, I will give it one big negative, is I took it on the road with me to Victoria. And I used all the features. I used the GPS. I used it in LTE mode. I used it to the nines for a very short period of time. And, boy, did that battery suck dry quick.
Yeah, I was interested in finding out yours and John's experience with the battery, because that was the biggest thing for me. Great, beautiful, bright screen, all these functions. But it has to last at least a day.
And no way.
It has to last from morning to night. I can't be running around trying to plug it in.
Zero chance of that if you're using all the features. Now, using the nav and everything else, I mean, I did push it. I didn't run video or audio, but I was using the radios a lot. So I think that if I did purchase this phone, if it was my phone, I think I would disable LTE most of the time. In order to increase the battery life. I think that you'd only use LTE when you're in a place where you can plug it in and you're kind of using it as a hotspot type thing.
I would probably do the opposite. I would probably either buy a second battery or just make sure I have lots of charging options with me, because once you have LTE speed for all your stuff, slowing down just isn't an option for me.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, and they do make it a lot easier to have the additional battery than does Apple, for example. You know, you can just have a second battery. Now, the batteries are probably going to be slightly expensive because they do have the RFID antenna built into the battery, right? So it's not going to be like third-party batteries are going to be able to be used in the Samsung Galaxy.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Yeah. But they do have some interesting charging options for it, too, because they also have the inductive charging back for it. And that's something you've played with, right, John?
Yeah, and that's actually a good point, because I have a coworker that has an S3, and you know, she's at her desk all day and she's using it while she's working and stuff to you know, play music and things like that, and she loves the idea that she could just put it down and it'd be charging while she's, you know, using it as an MP3 player
without plugging
it
in.
Up and go. Yeah.
And I wonder about one of the things about a Life Companion is I noticed that with that small USB adapter, that's an area that the phones tend to break down over time of being constantly plugged in and unplugged. I know I worked my way through several BlackBerry's USB connectors over the years. So the less that you have to plug it in, the better you are for wear and tear.
And that's the thing, is micro USB is a, you know, it's ubiquitous standard, but it's one of those weird plugs that, you know, you always get it in wrong when you're plugging it in.
It's so small, yeah. And it's
the nice thing about the Apple Lightning connector is that it doesn't work. Doesn't matter which way you plug it in.
Yeah, it's square.
And that's my only complaint about micro USB is the fact that I always plug it in upside down because it's hard to tell which way is up.
Okay, so there's so many features built into this thing that, tell me, did anything absolutely delight you, Jillian?
Well, John's the photographer here, but...
Yeah, I know. We'll get to the camera in a minute.
Yeah, I love the camera. But I think one of the things that Samsung's done that is very clever, very smart, and I'm sure Apple's going to have to do something along these lines because BlackBerry 10 has already done it, is they've divided the phone into that work and personal side.
Yes.
And I'm one of these people who carries two phones. I know a lot of people who do because your IT department, it just is not comfortable letting you have full control, so especially in this age of bring your own device to work. Steve, that if you tell your IT department, I'm bringing in my Android phone and I'm going to put it onto the corporate network, you know, they're gasped all the way around. And Samsung realizes this, and what they've done is they've added their own kind of layers of security, and then they took a leaf out of BlackBerry's book, and they've split the phone into a personal and a work side, so the IT department can take care of the, you know, the work side and all its apps and all the security. And yet, if you lose your phone or they decide to wipe it clean, you don't lose all your baby photos or the new puppy pictures or whatever other personal data you had on it.
Mm-hmm. So they call this Samsung's Knox. KNOX is their work versus play division, and it works very similar to BlackBerry Balance, but you do need server side support for it.
Exactly. So we can't. It's not something that we can try out on our demo phones.
Yeah.
And I haven't convinced my company to put it onto their network yet. But
even though they should be, right?
Absolutely. I hope they're listening, Steve.
Yes. Okay. So, John, what delighted you about it?
There was a couple of things that kind of surprised me that I actually found I was using quite a bit. One of the ones that I stumbled across by accident, I didn't even see it in any of the literature about the phone, was the optical reader. And what it's really good at is basically uses the onboard camera, and you can put it up to a sign, a book, or whatever, and it will actually recognize words, give you a dictionary explanation of them, even speak them out. And it just is kind of a really clever, truly a neat tool to have in your toolbox. If you come across something you're not familiar with, instead of having to type it out, you just basically hold the camera up to it. And
that's similar to
what it says.
Google has a tool that will do translating that way.
Yeah, but the thing is with the Google one is you have to be connected to the net.
Oh.
The S-Translate function is really cool as well because you can write or speak or type or speak in any language, and it'll convert it to any other language. And you can even download high-quality voices for each specific language. So if you're going traveling to Europe, for example, you just download in advance, and you don't need to be connected to the Internet while you're over there, which I thought was a great feature, and it's free. So.
Okay. I tested out quite heavily the voice recognition on the Samsung because I am a huge Siri fan. I'm one of the only people that loves Siri, I think. But I do love Siri on my iPhone, and so I checked out the voice recognition, used it quite extensively for dictating and texting and emailing, and it stands up. It's pretty good. It doesn't do quite as many, or at least I didn't discover ways to do quite as many kind of system-wide things, but the main voice dictation features are definitely there. You can say, you know, text John Beeler, message, put in the message, and it handles it very elegantly. I was very impressed with that feature.
Did you try the remote control, the Watch On app?
No, you mean for for TV?
Yeah.
No, I started to do that, and I never got through it. I don't know what stopped me. So explain that to us. Jillian, did you play with this?
I didn't.
Okay, this is cool stuff.
It took me getting my iPhone hooked up to the TV. But, John, tell us how it worked.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that they've done with the S4 is they've added an infrared port on the top of the device. So now you can sit in front of your TV, and you can actually control it. Like a wireless, you know, remote control, without having to actually pair with anything. You're literally just sending signals from a remote control on your phone to the TV or to the device. And the really neat thing is you put in your postal code, it shows you all the cable providers, brings up all the channels that you can actually get. You can do one click to, you know, start watching that show at a specific time. You can set up reminders so that, you know, okay, at 10 o'clock I'm going to go watch, you know, Storage Wars or whatever, and it'll pop up and remind you and even change the channel to that channel for you if you're in the proximity of your device.
And you sync it to your it's easy to configure it for your cable box?
Yeah, well, you basically pick from all the different devices, and if it doesn't have it, then it will actually cycle through all the different codes, and then you basically answer yes, no, saying it worked or didn't.
And what's the name of that app again? Because I did start to configure it, and then I stopped for some reason.
It's called Watch On.
Watch On, okay.
Yeah.
Watch
and
On,
it also
Watch
ties
Off.
Into things like Netflix and other things like that, so it really becomes like a sort of like a video hub, if you will, for content, whether it's on your device with Netflix or on your TV.
What it does is it establishes the S4 as firmly as the second screen in your living room.
That's right.
Because it is the remote control at that point as well. You can pop into your apps and stuff like that. So that is a pretty exciting addition. Now here's the one that disappointed me. And I'll start with the disappointments because other than the battery life, is I tried to make S Health work. And now Samsung is big on the health thing with measuring how many steps you take and having an interface with Bluetooth devices that monitor your exercise patterns and stuff. And for some reason, the software on my phone doesn't seem to go through the complete enrollment process, and it like literally just gets stuck. So maybe it's because it thinks I'm too chubby or something. I don't know. It says, "Oh no, he can't work out." But at any rate, I've gotten stuck. Did either of you get through the S Health at all?
I did, and that was one of the things I liked, Steve. I liked it because it said I only had to burn 900 calories a day, and then it told me exactly how to do it. And in fact, until I went to your beer and wings night, and there was a plate of nachos in front of me, I was doing really well. But then I found out I could take a picture of the plate of nachos, and then automatically it could figure out I could add it to the calories I'd had that day. What I really liked is it's not an app. Like, there are lots of apps that can combine together or do that kind of those S Health. I like that it's just there. The phone's in my pocket, and it's keeping track of all my activities, like the number of steps I'm taking in the day. I don't have to turn anything on or off. And then kind of like the future potential, because I think with e-health, there are a lot of things, anything from monitoring your blood pressure to, you know, all kinds of other remote patient monitoring. Potential is there, and that's already happening with the iPhone to a certain extent. There are a lot of pilots going on. So Samsung is clearly kind of trying to step into that arena.
And that is, I think the whole health area is nothing but growth as far as our mobility devices go. And the gamification of it, the fact that we're automatically getting feedback, we can, if we want, we can share this information with our friends and family or not share it. But the fact that we can turn it into a game and we can turn it into a conversation, as it were, is very compelling. And I think they're right on point with that. John, did you interface it with any other devices, John?
No, I didn't. I haven't tried any of the new NFC or the Wi-Fi Direct stuff, other than during the demo that we had initially. I explained it to a few people, and they're all kind of thinking, well, that's great if you have a lot of people with the same device.
Exactly. Jillian, in your demo, did they show you the poker game and the playing music through multiple phones at the same time?
You know, I loved it in the demo, but I'm kind of like John. I don't go to a lot of parties where everybody has an S4 unless I'm with you.
Well, that's it. I'm thinking at the next Beer and Wings night, we just hand one out to everybody as they come in.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been fine at the Beer and Wings. We could have had, not quite quadraphonic sound, but we would have, we could have all turned our phones into a speaker. But I don't know. How many times do you want to do that, Steve?
Exactly. So, okay.
But the nice thing about that, though, Steve, is that it's a feature that's there. You don't have to pay extra for. And if you do have, say, a bunch of kids together, in the back seat, they can do stuff like that without having any kind of a wireless connection and that type of thing. So it's one of those nice things to have, but I don't think it's a game changer per se.
Yeah. Okay, so Art's giving me the wrap-up, so I have to ask you the final question. You walk into your local TELUS or Rogers store today. You don't have a phone. You're buying a phone. What are you buying, Jillian Shaw?
Oh, that's such a tough one. I tell you right now, I came away from that demo with two real Apple fans from our video guy, Mark, and our digital editor, Bart. And they were split right down the middle, and I think this is going to be everybody. Mark's always had an iPhone. He said, I might be convinced by this to change. And what I can say is I think if Apple doesn't kind of come up with something, they have to up their game a bit with their next
No, release. No, that's I'm, not what I asked you, Ms. Shaw. Okay. I said you, what are you going to buy?
Well, I'm kind of locked into Apple right now with my iPad and my iMac and my Apple this and that. But I wouldn't, my iPhone 5 pales in comparation to this S4 I got.
But you'd still buy it. Okay. Jillian is still on the Apple bandwagon.
I'm just going to put off buying a phone, Steve.
Okay, fair enough. John Beeler, you walk into the store, what are you buying?
If I'm buying an Android phone, it's probably going to be the S4.
Okay. Oh, you hedged your bet too, but I thank you.
Oh, yeah, okay. You see, John, that was very clever. Should have thought of that.
He's a smart guy. Jillian Shaw can be Android. Jillian Shaw, you can find her work at the Vancouver Sun, John Beeler at johnbeeler.com. Thanks so much, you two.
Thanks, Steve.
Dototech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better. London Drugs. Nobody does it better. Except maybe you.
Are you slightly skeptical about Twitter? Many are, but not my guest, Don Power. Don is a social media guru from Nanaimo. How are you doing, Don?
I'm doing well, Steve. Good to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you too, Don. You got on that Twitter bandwagon when it was when it was still pretty, just kind of almost in its infancy, I guess.
I started in 2008, so that's 5 years ago now, and of course that's a lifetime and a half in social media.
Yeah, and you kind of are walking the walk. You live most of your life on. It seems to me every time I turn on Twitter, every time I check my Twitter feed, you are there. You're one of the few people I follow, but you also are a bit of a proselytizer for the technology. You believe Twitter is a terrific tool, and so much so that you've put your money where your mouth is and written a book, Twitter for Skeptics.
That's right.
I'm still slightly skeptical, so this book is for me. Did you dedicate it to me in the foreword?
I probably should have, because it's for folks like you that literally keep me in business and specifically for whom I wrote the book. So
okay. So what now, I know what my concerns around Twitter are. What do you hear the most? Like when you hear people say this about Twitter, what's the thing that drives you the most crazy?
Yeah, so the thing that kind of drives me the most crazy, the thing that's sort of most popular, even still like 5-6 years on, is that Twitter is nothing more than just a bunch of people tweeting about their breakfast. That phrase, that physical phrase, has made it in as my number one objection in the book, and it's one that I hear all the time in my speaking presentations.
When we know it's they're tweeting about lunch.
Yeah, well, the funny part is that I actually give a personal example of how tweeting about your breakfast can be good for business.
Okay.
And that's sort of the focus of the book. It is for the use of social media in a business context, and that's why I try to tell people that, you know, Twitter isn't just about inane conversations between people. It actually, the conversations about people end up leading to a great business purpose and opportunity, and that's sort of the whole idea you mentioned earlier about me being a proselytizer. That's definitely it. I want people to understand that Twitter is the best opportunity engine that the world has ever seen.
So how do you deal with my biggest concern, which is Twitter is like, I kind of feel when I'm doing my workday, Twitter is like the river that's flowing by outside of my, you know, if I was lucky enough to have a beautiful house on the shores of a fast moving river. and whenever I look out, I see something interesting happening on the river. I see cargo ships going by. I see, you know, birds flying by. I see things, logs floating down the river. Yeah. But it's only when I'm noticing them and looking out at the river that I see it. And a whole bunch of stuff can happen on the river during the day, and I don't know anything about it because I'm busy with my head buried in work.
So I actually use an analogy of a fast-flowing river as well, because it is pretty clear.
I thought it was totally original.
One of the things I talk about is that if you can envision yourself being in a small little boat that you're in out in the river, and there's all this data stream coming at you, the further upstream you can make the connections to people, the better connections you're going to have and the more meaningful they are. So sort of my whole thing about trying to teach people on how to use Twitter most effectively is to try to get those messages and connections as far upstream as possible. In other words, yes, it's a real-time medium, but there are tools you can use to really get in front of it as opposed to being swept downstream by it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the things that I teach people is specific strategies and tactics of how to do that.
So give me some examples of the kind of tools and the kind of early engagement.
Sure. Two things I think that immediately come to mind that are probably among the most effective tools for Twitter specifically are the use of hashtags.
Mm-hmm.
And a hashtag is basically a pound symbol. It's a symbol where you, when you include that in a tweet, the keyword becomes searchable. So all of a sudden now you have a searchable term that anyone in the world can actually see your tweet, even people who aren't on Twitter can search for hashtags and see conversations on Twitter. So, for instance, you could have a hashtag for instance, the Boston issue that just happened. You know, it could be Marathon or it could be Boston. So you can just plug that in to Twitter or even on Google and get up-to-date information that's happening on that particular topic, breaking news. For a business context, you could, if you're selling, you know, let's say skis, you could use a hashtag skis to see exactly what people are talking about right now, mentioning the word skis in their tweets. So instead of it being this massive river where you got millions of people talking about millions of different topics, you can use hashtags as one example to focus in on the specific topics that are meaningful to you.
Okay, and so that creates some additional focus.
Yeah.
The other big thing that I have issues with, and that others do as well, is how much time should I be spending engaged in Twitter? I mean, my email alone takes up, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day of time responding in direct dialogue in that area, and then research, and then, you know, normal work and accounting. How do I then find the kind of time? Now, I know that you live in Twitter. At least if you don't, you have a doppelganger that does, because you're there so often. But how does the average business person then find the time to engage?
Right. Well, it definitely, that finding the time is a big objection that I hear quite commonly. And in fact, it made it into the book as its own chapter, as an objection. I don't have time to tweet. And again, there are physical tools. I work for a company called Sprout Social, as an example, that is a management tool. So it physically filters your Twitter stream so that you can be very, very effective and efficient on it. But whether or not you're using a physical tool or not, basically the tenet holds true that the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. So if you are only tweeting, you know, 5 minutes a day, you will get certain things out of it. But quite honestly, you will get more out of it the more time that you put in. My whole thing is that when people, when I advise them to spend more time and they start to see some of the results and the opportunities that begin to appear as if by magic out of nowhere, that's the convincing that they need when they actually see it working. And then they spend the appropriate amount of time because they see the opportunity that they can get from it. So I think you have to start by forcing yourself to make time, but within a very short time, you'll find that your efforts are paying off in spades.
I'm probably missing some very important groups, but the two big kind of franchises that I see in Twitter are the group of people who are engaged in dialogue, who are actively engaged in conversations and out there talking all the time, and look like they're gleaning a lot of intel, a lot of opportunity out of their conversation. That's one group. The other group is the group which is just trying to use Twitter as a reputation-building tool. So trying to build up, almost keeping score. And we do. We have tools like Clout that keep score of your influence, primarily based on Twitter. So trying to say, look, I'm important, I'm relevant, look at my Twitter score. And so trying to build reputation or street credibility in Twitter. Are those the two main groups?
Well, I mean, I think the two you've described, you kind of can't have one without the other, in my opinion. In other words, by being a conversationalist and by out interacting with people and engaging in conversations, you're naturally going to build your reputation. You can't build a good reputation just simply by tweeting links all day, even if the information is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really have to spend time interacting. So, you know, to me, those two things you described are definitely belong sort of in the same equation. Other folks who use the use the medium to great effect are people who combine both, so who are conversationalists but also have great links to other information that isn't just their own conversations. And as an example, I write and edit for a social media blog from Sprout Social. It's called Sprout Social Insights, and we post free information on how all of these tools and platforms work. So I'm not only engaging in physical conversation with people, I'm also posting information to articles that I've written, and of course to articles that other people have written on the subject as well. So the third group is people who not only engage in conversation, but also post and make sure that they interact and share other important information as well.
The other thing I'm looking for is it does in cases where we have cases where there's a massive event, like you were talking about the Boston Marathon tragedy, where Twitter breaks away from its kind of navel-gazing and starts to look at what's happening in the world and deals with a real-world situation. But so often, the conversation is about social media, is about the effect of social media, how social media is working, and so it's almost nepotistic where Twitter seems to be talking about Twitter, and so much of the conversation is about kind of the internal mechanisms and the group that's involved in social media.
Yeah,
am I off base with that perception?
Well, I certainly don't think that that's all there is, or even the majority of what there is on Twitter. But it is a valid point in that there are still the majority of individuals and businesses out there who aren't on the platform. So they don't know the nuances of using hashtags or lists or being able to filter information to find the reliable influencers like you talked about earlier. So there are still millions and millions of people, and literally every week millions and millions more, who need that evaluation of the tool. In other words, they kind of need people like me to talk about the platform itself and how to best use it, as opposed to just the information gathering itself. And there's over a billion people on Facebook, as an example, and the numbers are hard to get, but probably between 1 and 300 million on Twitter. So it's a third or a fourth the size, and so there's more people coming onto the platform all the time, and they still need that information about sort of what Twitter is and why I should be using it. And that was really the main motivator for me to write this book in the first place.
So Twitter for Skeptics is available online at Amazon?
Yes, it's at Amazon.com, and people can just search for the book title Twitter for Skeptics. Or if it's easier, I've got a landing page at twitterforskeptics.com that has sample chapters for the book, information about what the book is about, and, of course, ordering information. They can order there to link to the sales page on Amazon.
And get it online or get it as a real book. I'm going to be fat. And you self-published this, did you, Don?
I did, yes.
Know, I'm always interested in that process. I think I'm going to have to book you on, and we're going to have to talk about, not about Twitter, but talk about the process of writing and self-publishing a book.
Yeah, I would love that, because it's been an eye-opener for me as well, and the punchline is really how easy it's been, and I think it can enable a lot of people who've been thinking about writing a book to actually get it out of their head and onto paper, and I'd be fascinated and love to talk about that to your audience as well.
Twitter for Skeptics. We'll have a link to it on our site. This is Don Power, and you can follow him, of course, at Don Power is his Twitter handle. Thanks so much, Don.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better. Brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Indeed, nobody does it better than Julian Sanders. Julian joins me now from his customary haunts in deepest, darkest Saskatchewan. How are you doing, Julian?
Pretty good. We still have a lot of snow here, but otherwise, I'm doing great. How about you, Steve?
We don't have a lot of snow here.
Oh, well, you guys are lucky. Spring must be treating you nice.
Did we have any snow this year, Art? I can't even remember. Did we have any?
I think it dusted.
Yeah, I don't remember shoveling once.
No.
No, so I think we...
I'll pack some up and send some your way then.
You can just keep it. We get enough immigrants from Saskatchewan coming out to watch football games here, so that's enough. That's enough. So how are things, Julian? What you want to talk today about? Tablet computers that think they're notebooks.
Right. The whole shape of computers has really changed over the last even just the last few months.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have seen touchscreen computers. A lot of people are used to having a tablet like an iPad or, you know, smartphones that have been around for quite some time. But now the whole trend is moving all the way into right into the computer itself. So there's a lot of new ways you can interact with your computer.
And can we kind of lay this more at Microsoft's feet than at Apple's feet?
I would say so, yeah. Apple doesn't make a touchscreen computer, so the PC guys have really stepped up. We carry a ton of laptops with touchscreens that look like regular laptops. We have about a dozen models at any given day where you can reach up and scroll through the tiles very quickly, pull up some information. So it's a really, really nice way. It could be a lot faster than using a mouse.
Well, you mean just sitting down with your notebook and reaching and touching the screen, which I'm not sure I'm crazy about. I know I used to, on our TV show, we showed the first iterations of these touchscreen computers that were all-in-ones with a touchscreen, and they were designed like often for kitchen use and that sort of thing. But I always thought that I didn't want somebody's greasy fingers touching my screen, and that's still the issue I have around notebooks with touchscreens. Help me out there.
That's a valid point, actually. One of the things they've innovated over the last several years is really good coatings for touchscreens. So you don't see the grease, and just a good microfiber.
It's still there.
And it won't. A lot of people think, you know, the more you use it, it'll wear off. But the touchscreen will outlast the hardware itself that's running the computer. So a good microfiber cloth. We even have things to sanitize them quickly and safely. So a good cleaning, and you're okay to go there. If you're worried about the grubbies, they've got you covered.
So when a person comes into the store today shopping for a notebook computer, how focused are they on a classic notebook? We're not talking about the Apple world, of course, but if they're in the Windows world, how focused are they on a classic notebook, and how much of a conversation do they have around, should I be getting a convertible tablet or should I be getting a notebook?
Well, it depends on what you want to use it for, and usually it depends on what you already have. A lot of people are looking for a computer because they've got one that's old. Some people have purchased a tablet, a first generation, something a couple of years ago, and now they're looking at replacing their whole computer because they're tired of the limitations of the laptop, or maybe they, you know, can't install their tax software or something on there. And it's a good option for people that want to replace their system with something that can serve two purposes, especially if you're not always using your computer in one place, because that's been the big thing. Everybody wants to unplug and run out the door and keep their contacts, keep their computer with them to do everything they're used to. So having the convertible style, it gives you a lot of choices to where you can use it and how you can use it, so you're not stuck with just a touchscreen. You're not stuck with just a laptop that you have to whip out and put on your knees. It gives you a lot more flexibility.
So walk me through the size of these. So does it start with 11-inch tablets, really, that have keyboards attached that some of the manufacturers just kind of go and kind of almost turn into little mini notebooks? Is that the beginning of the form factor?
It is, yeah. The 11-inch seems to be about the smallest usable because the 10-inch tablet's being quite popular. There's a couple of touchscreen laptops from Asus that are even at entry-level prices. There's the X202 11-inch laptop with a touchscreen, and it's $549, and it gives you basic specs. So it's really a replacement, kind of like a high-end netbook. For specs. So it gives you the long battery life without having to spend a lot of money. Then there's ones where you can actually take the screen right off the laptop.
Yes. So
those are what really boggle people sometimes. Now, Asus started it off with a dock for, with basically they had a keyboard and a screen and you could pop the screen off. Mm-hmm. It was running Android. We still have those. They're quite popular. And now the HP guys have come out with their own. The HP Envy X2 is an 11-inch convertible with a removable screen. So it's really a thing to see. It's something you should put your hands on. Basically, when you have the screen in your hands, you've got the guts of the computer on you. So you can use it like you would a tablet that you use just with touch. The keyboard will pop up on screen when you need it. And then it has a hinge on the keyboard that you snap the screen into, and then you've got your real keys, you've got USB ports, and HDMI.
Okay.
So it gives you all of the features.
Now, this X2, is it the equivalent of a Microsoft Surface tablet when it's disconnected, or is it limited more than the Surface would be?
It's the same software. It has Windows 8 full. It doesn't have a tablet version of the operating system. But to keep the price down, HP decided to go with a little bit different group of specs inside of the speed of the computer. So it's an Atom-based processor, 2 gigs of RAM, and a 64 gig solid-state storage drive. So it really gives you a little bit less for total power overall, but it keeps the price down while still giving you a full PC.
Why would you consider that, other than price, over getting something like the Surface and just getting a more skookum keyboard for the Surface?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question that a lot of people have asked me. Yeah, I get that pretty much every time now when I'm showing somebody the X2, and the big answer is battery life, because it'll give you about a 6 to 8 hour battery life without the dock connected. With the dock connected, it'll give you 8 to 10 hours.
So there's two batteries. There's one in the dock. There's one in the screen.
Right. Yeah. And the two combined are advertised at about 10 hours. And I'd say without having to go into ridiculous energy settings or energy efficient settings, you'd get about 8 hours.
What is the dream system if I want the absolute best tablet configuration keyboard? What's like? The HP starts at about $600. The Surface tablet starts at about $100 more than that. I think it is. But if money is no object, what am I going to be buying?
Well, there's actually two for money is no object. My favorite is the one I'll say first. It's the Asus Tai Chi dual screen laptop, and it's $1,299. So it's actually not that much compared to, say, a high end PC. It has very good specs. It's like buying a nice ultrabook with an i5, 4 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage. But the way Asus has made it, so it sits on the shelf, looks like a regular laptop, 11-inch screen on the inside. They used a gorgeous IPS panel, so the colors are very vibrant, mm-hmm. very good for text. And then on the back side of the laptop, instead of just having a lid, they have a touch screen on the back.
A second screen.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
So basically, you close the computer, pick it up while it's closed, and you've got a tablet. It's full Windows 8. You have access to all of the same stuff that you would have if you open the laptop. It has a very nifty utility that's very stable for showing things on the second screen. So you can even set it up with somebody at a table and have them see something else while you're controlling something on the other side.
So you can just for presentation. So it's a dual screen. Now, is this, are both screens the same quality?
The IPS panels on the inside, they used a high-end LED on the backside. So it has a finish just like a 11-inch tablet does. So the colors on the other side aren't amazing, but they're the same as on most laptops.
That's ridiculous.
And
So what they've done is they've gone with two screens as opposed to the traditional way of doing this, which is through a hinge, which would spin and allow you to flip the panel over.
Right, and that keeps the computer very thin. It's about 3.5 inches at its thickest point.
Two screens makes it thinner than the hinging option?
Because the hinge has more mechanisms in it to do the locking and the flipping.
And it has to be more robust, yeah.
Right, yeah, and they've made this very sleek. So when it's closed and you're using it as a tablet, it actually is it's a little bit about 2 millimeters thicker than the original iPad was.
There we go, the Asus Tai Chi, $1,200. That is, I don't know, I almost don't have words for it. Very interesting. Okay, what was the other one that you liked?
The other one was the Toshiba slider. So they call this a U920. It has a very nerdy name, but the U920 has a screen that slides over top of the keyboard. So there's no flipping it around, and it keeps it very thin. It's, again, the same Ultrabook specs that you're used to seeing, i5, 4 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of storage. Mm-hmm. And you can either use it in a regular laptop when it's sitting up, or you can put the screen flat. You basically just push on the screen and it lays down flat, and then it slides over the keyboard. The back of the screen slides over the keyboard.
Oh, so they do it with a hinge in the bezel of the screen as opposed to in the bottom attached to the keyboard itself.
Right. And yeah. The advantage to the Toshiba is it has a couple of more ports, and it gives you the same reliability that Toshiba is famous for. So it's a very strong option from them. The touch, it's also a little bit bigger of a screen, so somebody looking for something that's not an 11-inch, it's a nice convertible with decent speeds for multitasking, and it also has wireless displays, so you can do wide-eye should you have that, which the Asus, unfortunately, doesn't have.
Okay, and it costs about the same as the Asus does.
Right, and it's a 12.5-inch screen.
But it's bigger, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a little bit bigger, and it starts at $1,150 for that one.
Wow. So we're seeing, does all of this movement towards these either touchscreen or tablet-enabled notebooks or tablet combination notebooks, have they basically killed the netbook?
Yeah, they have, yeah. It hasn't been manufactured for a while. Asus's EPC lineup was officially discontinued.
Yeah, so that's it. So this is the direction we're going. I think we're ahead of the game with it. So that's good. Julian, if you want to see, I think if you're going to make a decision on a touchscreen notebook or a tablet convertible into a notebook, you got to touch them, you got to see them. And the place to do that, tell me where, Julian.
London Drugs.
Amen, sister. I'm buying what you're preaching. Good. Julian Saunders is, of course, he's the computer manager at London Drugs there in beautiful downtown Saskatoon. Thanks so much, Julian.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better.
Do you have a comment or question for Dottotech?
Visit our website at dottotech.com and click on Contact Us. Dottotech is brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. Now, back to Steve.
It is that wonderful time of the year. There's only two groups of people, maybe three groups of people, I think, that think this is wonderful. The CAs, the CGAs, I guess bookkeepers. Well, maybe they don't think it's wonderful because I know they're working their tails off, but they sure make a lot of money this time of year. Joining me online now is Eileen Reppenhagen. Eileen is a specialist in all things accounting. She trains people on QuickTax and TurboTax and those sorts of things. And I know, Eileen, from having the conversations with you, one of your big concerns is the issue of financial literacy, that we're graduating kids from school with really no understanding at all of how finances work. And we're not doing anybody a service by doing that, are we?
No, and what concerns me is the definition of financial literacy. And the federal government proposed financial literacy was, you know, something we needed to be concerned about, but they purposefully left out tax. So there's this whole realm of tax literacy that's not being included, and they claim that Canada Revenue Agency is responsible for providing tax information. And if people don't even know where to go to or how to find tax information on the CRA website, they're going to have a problem.
And expecting the CRA to be our communicator of tax-related information, excuse me, they're good at the details of tax, but they are so afraid of saying anything wrong. They're so politically correct, and their information is so put through the ringer that it comes out almost with, like, it's almost like food without nutritional value to actually get through and actually understand what's going on. You just go there and you leave feeling quite empty.
Well, you're talking about it like it's pablum, but the reality is that the CRA website is incredibly complex, and the search engine and the sitemap on the CRA website are awesome places to get a ton of information. But you have to understand the language first.
Yeah, that's
like speaking a totally different language. It's like learning, it's like math. My husband teaches math, and he tells me that there is a dictionary of math. There needs to be a dictionary of tax. And the CRA website tries to be that without actually claiming they are, and without really providing enough ways to learn the language. But you know what? They've been getting a little better. They've got new videos out. Mm-hmm. Like, if you go to their website, there's some new training videos that aren't half bad.
Okay.
And I'm not defending them, but there is some new stuff coming out. And one of the things that they've launched recently is something called Folios, F-O-L-I-O-S. And they are replacing the interpretation bulletins and the technical news bulletins that they've produced for years. And those are actually written by the finance department. And those interpretations are posted on the Canada Revenue Agency website. What's not on the Canada Revenue Agency website are the rulings. And you have to pay for those.
That seems to me the sort of information that should be free and available.
You would think so, but the only people that get access are the people who can afford it, and they sell subscriptions. And that would be the CCHs and the Carswells.
Okay.
And this fellow is a private entrepreneur in Toronto, I believe, and he got access through finance to the rulings, and he's posting them on his website for free to drive traffic to his website.
Oh, well, that should be pretty successful.
Well, I hope so for him.
As long as he's not breaking the law. I mean, the one group that you don't want kind of cheesed off at you is CRA. I mean, you know, or the revenue agency. You know, there's lots of different government groups that it's okay to have them kind of ticked at you, but they aren't the ones that it's okay.
No.
Okay, let's talk about what you're doing to address this situation, because I know that you've got an initiative going that's available for educators and teachers, and you're trying to, and you are concerned about this financial literacy thing. So you've developed some resources for kids at what area in high school should they be teaching this stuff, first of all?
Well, probably at the point where they're getting jobs in grade 11 and 12.
And what classes though?
There's a little bit in the Planning 10.
Okay.
They do cover a little bit of financial.
I call it Home Ec. That shows my age.
Yeah,
Home Ec.
No,
Planning 10.
Yeah, Planning 10. They have financial life skills for Planning 10. There's a teacher binder put out by, get this, the BC Securities Commission.
Oh, okay.
And the BC Securities Commission has attempted, they have the same concerns I do. They've felt that there was nothing in the curriculum that addressed tax or financial literacy, and they felt that they should do something and put together this incredible binder for teachers that's a resource.
Okay.
The problem is that there is nothing in the curriculum to drive teachers to teach this stuff.
Okay.
So our British Columbia curriculum has no requirement to cover tax. So okay. If they have time at the end of the year and they have nothing to do and they're looking for something to do, or they're looking for a free speaker,
mm-hmm.
which they will do. They'll bring in CGAs who have volunteered for years through the public school system, and CAs and CMAs as well. They all do it. They do it because they're doing it for recruitment to get mm-hmm. students. And they'll come into the accounting classes. And they'll talk about tax, because there is a bit of tax in the accounting, but it's more about accounting for tax. It's not tax return preparation.
Okay.
And it's not really about planning for tax or thinking about how tax impacts your life. And those are the kinds of things that I'm attempting to do. I'm saying, let's do some stories. Mm-hmm. And I have on my website 5 stories. Which you can work through, and 2 of them I created videos for. So you could go to TurboTax Online, which is free access to that, and you could create up to 20 case studies anonymously using zeros for your SIN number, and the teacher can set up a Gmail account so that all the students don't get mail from TurboTax Online afterwards, because they all do these marketing things, right?
Of course, yeah.
So what the teacher does is sets up a Gmail account. The kids all go in with fake social insurance numbers and fake names, and they can play. And they can save their work and go back and edit it, and they can create up to 20 case studies for free. And I've been working with Joanne DePalma at Intuit to set that up so that basically those kids can go in there. They can play around. UFile does the same thing. They have a similar program where you can go in and set up anonymous tax returns. What you need to know is that at some point it's going to say, if you go beyond this point, you're going to have to pay. But you have to read it carefully, because it says you're going to have to pay to file. So if you never e-file, you will never pay.
Okay.
Okay, so you can use the software anonymously for free and play. And what better way to learn about tax than just to play?
And at that point there, it's exposing them to what they're going to be, to all, by filling in the tax returns and playing with different scenarios, they are starting to, by default, think about the implications of all of their actions.
Absolutely. They are going to play with things like, okay, what if I earn $1 million and I have to have open heart surgery in Texas? How much medical expenses can I claim if it costs me $200,000 for the surgery? So you go online, you fill it all in, and you discover you can claim $198,000 of the medical expenses. So
it's almost worth it.
It's almost worth it to fly to Texas to have your surgery.
So where do people go to get this information? Now, if parents are interested in letting the teachers know, what's the website?
Yeah. The website is taxdetective.ca. And that's taxdetective.ca. And if you go to the second tab at the top, it's under the free stuff, and there is a student workbook on tax. And I have loaded the 3 videos, the intro video and 2 case study videos, into YouTube so that you can play them streaming video. You don't have to load them onto your computer if you don't want to. And the instructions for how to do all of that, plus a whole bunch of links for the various case studies. Case study 1 is working at McDonald's. Case study 2 is self-employed paper route. Case study 3 is server in a pizza parlor. 4 is a student goes away to University of Toronto and moves home to work in the summer for 4 months. Adult first full-time job, including travel health insurance, extended health benefit premiums, and then just some more information.
Okay.
I have tons of useful links there. Under my free stuff, you'll find other stuff as well.
Yeah. Now, and on your site, you've also got tutorials. If people are in business, you've got some great tutorials around using QuickTax and in offering advice in that area. So you've got a lot of resources at taxdetective.ca. But the topic today is this financial literacy. And as we're moving through tax season, you know, thinking back to when all of us started out in our adult life, if we'd had a little better training, and I just wish I'd known more. You know, as I started, we'd be so far ahead. So maybe that's a lesson, and we can pay some attention to it. And thank you very much for putting those resources and making them available to us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That's Eileen Reppenhagen, taxdetective.ca. It's all about financial literacy, folks.
Just a quick reminder that we have just a few days left for you to enter to win a copy of Microsoft Office 365, which we are giving away this month on Dottotech. Just drop by our website at dottotech.com. There, of course, you find lots of other great stuff, like links to our old podcasts, my videos, lots of fun stuff. And, so enter to win. That's it, Art. We run out of time.
That's it.
Oh, good stuff. Well, we'll see you next week right here for more Dottotech.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.